broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less. As well as if a promontory were, as well as any manner of thy friends or of thine own were, any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. John Donne, Meditation 17, Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions, probably written around 1623. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. In this day of individualism, characterized by tribalism and isolation, John Donne's admonition that no man is an island entire of itself is almost a cliché. There's a tendency to believe that we are unique. We owe nothing to anyone. But certainly, we would do well to remember that Donne is right. We are all a piece of the continent, a part of the main. The great Sir Isaac Newton, in a letter to Robert Hooke, the natural philosopher, referenced his own accomplishments by saying, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants." Well, we all stand on the shoulders of others. T.S. Eliot offers a great example by suggesting his debt to the French poet Jules Lafogue. In his introduction to Ezra Pound's Selected Poems, Eliot acknowledged that he had drawn his form directly from the study of Lafogue, together with the later Elizabethan drama. And scholars note Eliot's debt to the French poet's themes, imagery, and rhythms in his early poems, but suggest that Eliot went much further and deeper than Lafogue in his later verse. So today, on Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition, we're going to talk about influence and the shoulders of the giants on whom three of our significant Eastern Shore poets stand: Sue Ellen Thompson, Ann Colwell, and Adam Tavell. Sue Ellen Thompson has published 5 books of poetry, served as editor of the 2005 edition of the Autumn House Anthology of Contemporary American Poetry, and is the recipient of numerous awards, including nomination for the Pulitzer Prize and winner of the 2010 Maryland Author Award. Her poems have been read a number of times on National Public Radio's The Writer's Almanac. Ann Colwell has written 2 books of poetry, a critical book on the poetry of Elizabeth Bishop, and numerous articles and short stories. She has received a number of awards, including an Established Artist Award in Poetry and an Emerging and Established Artist Award in Fiction from the Delaware State Arts Council. Anne is currently an associate professor of English at the University of Delaware. Adam Tavel has written 3 books of poetry. He is the recipient of a number of awards as well, including the Robert Frost Award from the Robert Frost Foundation, and recently the Richard Wilbur Award for his 3rd book, Catafalque. Adam is a professor of English at Warwick Community College. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you, Hal.
Let me begin with a general question. In doing a little research about authors, great authors who were influenced by others, what I found fairly often was an enumeration by them of their favorite books. And I thought to myself, well, wait a minute, not necessarily your favorite book, but who influenced you? And so what does it mean to be influenced by someone rather than just, well, I really liked their book? So the 3 of you, talk for just a moment about influence and what influence means.
Well, to me, influence means that your writing has been changed somehow by exposure to another poet's work. Sometimes it's just a matter of wanting to be influenced, of wishing you could write like someone else, or consciously trying to incorporate elements of their style or subject matter or whatever, but not necessarily succeeding in that effort. Having a favorite author, I think, just means that you love their work, you admire it. And that's often because they write in a way that you don't or could never hope to. I put Yeats and Stevens in that category for me.
Anne?
I definitely think that's true, that in some cases, actually, my favorite authors are not people I write like at all, because I couldn't. But sometimes I think influence is a little more subconscious or unconscious than having a favorite author. That there are some kinds of influence that you actually seek out, like you're going to write a poem in response to a poem. But I think that real influence is more like you don't even know you're writing the poem in response to a poem, that it's that deep.
Adam?
For me, I think it's twofold, and I've been wrestling with this question for a while. I think it's a powerful and complicated question. But on the one hand, I think it's a way of seeing the world. And what I mean by that is I have some favorite writers, but they amaze me because of their technical ability. But the writers that I think influence us as poets are the ones that help us see the complexity and the duality of the world in ways that maybe on some deep emotional level we are aware of, but we had never had the language for. And I think the second thing for me is also language, the use of language, what is possible, and whether it's in terms of things like vocabulary, diction, but also in terms of tone and resonance and the musicality of like a poetic line or a turn of phrase. And for me, those are things that are marrow deep and that they kind of change you at the cellular level when you go to make your own poems in the sort of isolation of your study, right?
Well, let me come back to you, Sue Ellen, and ask you, who would you say then, using this term influence that you've so wonderfully defined, all 3 of you, who would you say is the writer, not necessarily poet, but the writer who has influenced your work the most?
I distinctly remember reading Sharon Olds's 2nd and 3rd books, The Dead and the Living and The Gold Cell, when I was just beginning to get really serious about poetry and thinking, wow, she is really brave. She wrote about her parents, her children, the men in her life, you know, subjects that I wanted to write about too, but I didn't know how to approach it without risking either sentimentality or mortification or outright offense.
What age were you, Sue Ellen, when you were, or what era in your writing were you when you were reading Sharon Olds?
I was in my 30s, probably my mid-30s at the time. And she was a bit older, maybe.
Was this an impressionable period for you?
I was a new mother, so that might have made me somewhat impressionable. Yes, that's very possible. But the interesting thing is when I told a poet, a male poet friend of mine, that I had just discovered Sharon Olds and thought she was amazing, his reaction, he was far more established in his career than I was, Sharon Olds, she's embarrassing. Wow. So that told me something. Maybe I've been reading too many male poets. But then later in my career, after I'd published a couple of books, I discovered Jane Kenyon, who was actually very close to me in age. And she had such a different approach to the same subject matter. And I remember thinking, I want to write somewhere between the two. I want to have Sharon Olds' courage, and I want the quiet restraint of Jane Kenyon.
That's so funny because I have a Jane Kenyon poem open in front of me.
Do you really?
I do.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Well, read us on a little bit of Sharon Olds, if you would, and talk to us about how that influenced your own writing.
Okay. I will read a poem that this is from her book, The Father. I think that was maybe her fourth book, and it's about visiting her father in the hospital for the last time, and it's called The Lumens. He is better. He is dying a little more slowly. His skin gleams like wet silver. He tilts his face up to me, and it flushes faintly rose, like a tray reflecting the flowers it holds. They have drained the blood out of his body and replaced it with fresh blood from the people of Redwood City. They have washed his hair, and it lifts in a slow wave above his brow. They shave him, and he glistens more. His skin is glossy. He puts on his silver reading glasses, and he glitters. He lifts his eyelids, and mild sluices of shining come out of his eyes. It is frightening to see how much light this night man has had in him, but we are not frightened. Luminous, he sits up for minutes at a time and jokes. We laugh, the nurses come in, and each has a lumen around her folded cap. Each particle of air is capped with brightness, and he does not snuff it. Before he dies, my father dies as an extinguisher. For minutes at a time, he shines before he dies.
And how has that influenced you, Sue Ellen? Except... I shouldn't say this, but I can see Sue Ellen all over that poem, frankly,
well, you know,
in terms of reading your own work, particularly your writing about your father when he was in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. I came back to this poem 20 years later when my father was dying. And I read it. I mean, I think initially I was just drawn to the way she uses sound in that poem, which is extraordinary to me. But when I was actually dealing with the same subject, I thought, oh, that poem by Sharon Olds, I'm going to go back and read that. And then I'm going to try to write about the last time I saw my father. And I did.
And you did. Who else, Sue Ellen? Is there anyone else who influenced you?
Well, I would have to say Stephen Dunn, who won the Pulitzer maybe 15 years ago, something like that, was a poet who really made quite an impression on me. He wrote the way I wanted to write. And then he actually came to the town in Connecticut where I was living and stayed with me overnight. And I drove him to the airport the next day and had a chance to really talk to him. And I've been seeking out his work ever since.
Do you have something by Dunn that you can read for us?
No, I have something by Kenyon.
Well, tell us about Jane Kenyon and her influence on you, and then read something by Kenyon.
Okay. I think what I learned, I learned two things really from Jane Kenyon. One thing was to pay more attention to the natural world and to use it as a way of talking about inner states of mind. And I think I also learned from her how powerful it is to speak through metaphor. How that was an avenue to deal with really strong emotion in a restrained way that also made it less individual to me and more open to other people. And this is a very short poem, just a couple of stanzas, which is entirely metaphor. It's called In the Nursing Home. She is like a horse grazing a hill pasture that someone makes smaller by coming every night to pull the fences in and in. She has stopped running wide loops, stopped even the tight circles. She drops her head to feed. Grass is dust and the creek bed's dry. Master, come with your light halter. Come and bring her in.
Oh. Beautiful. Do you have one of your own poems that reflects Kenyon's influence?
Well, I could read from my most recent book, They, the poem that was influenced by Sharon Olds, The Lumens, and it's called simply The Last Time I Saw My Father. He couldn't sleep, couldn't get comfortable in the hospital bed we'd brought into his room, would push a button and his feet would rise up to the ceiling. He had no appetite. He was thirsty, but drinking only made him want to pee, and he couldn't do that either. In the middle of the night, I found him sitting with his thin legs dangling off the bed, pajama bottoms halfway to his knees, one hand holding what I didn't want to see, the plastic urinal tipped over on the table, out of reach. With sudden clarity, he looked at me and asked, "Are we drilling today?" I thought he might be dreaming about the VA dental clinic, where he had endured 6 decades of extractions, root canals, and a series of bridges that never seemed to work or fit, the legacy of his stay in a German POW camp. But then I realized that it was 1943, and he was back in Lubbock, Texas, in the Army Air Corps. "No drills today," I told him, and this seemed to comfort him. "Good," he said, and then, "I'm tired," closing his eyes as if he knew that nothing further would be required.
Sue Ellen, give us a little bit of a timeline here. What were you writing before Sharon Olds, and you found this influence? How did your writing change as a result of reading both Jane Kenyon and Sharon Olds?
Well, as I said earlier, I was a young mother when I discovered Sharon Olds, and she was writing very frank poems about her children and about domestic life and about marriage, which I had been educated to believe were not appropriate subjects for poetry. She made me bolder. And that really carried through a couple of decades later when I was writing the poems in They. These were poems that I had put aside because they were too personal. And I didn't think I could articulate emotion that profound. But then I would go back and read her. And she kept publishing books and winning prizes, and she just made me bolder.
Let me ask you this, Sue Ellen. What does it mean to write in a bolder fashion? Does it mean that you conquered your own sensitivity to your personal feelings, or what made you willing to, in one sense, open yourself up in your poetry the way Sharon Olds did?
Yeah, I think there were whole subject matter areas that I just closed off, or if I did write about them, no one saw those poems ever. And of course, over the years, that was the pile that was getting higher. And the poems that were suitable for publication, or so I thought, you know, were many fewer. I remember going back and studying her language. And she has some very unusual diction and some extremely unusual metaphors, and thinking maybe that's a way I could be braver, you know, by concentrating on the specific instead of worrying about what will people think of me if I write about this.
She gave you courage.
Mm-hmm. She gave me courage.
Anne, let me ask you the same influence question. Who has influenced most your writing?
That is a hard question, I think, but especially a hard question for me, because I got interested in poetry when I was very young. So I grew up in a house that was full of books. My dad was a kind of a closet writer. And so I started reading Robert Frost and Emily Dickinson young. And I think it's interesting because they're different kinds of poets, but they're so American. I'm sure Frost has an influence on me because Frost has an influence. If you're writing in poetry in English in America, Robert Frost is there for you. But Dickinson was the first one she showed me that you could be a woman and be a poet. And I think that was huge. It was amazing.
Let me ask you, Anne, what does that mean to be a woman and be a poet? What are you driving at? I could have a more sophisticated way of asking that question, but frankly,
well,
I can't think of it.
I think it's actually some of what Sue Ellen is saying, is that there are whole ideas, like universal poems, and I grew up with the same bias. Universal poems were poems that weren't about being a woman. Poems about being a woman were women poets, right? Like if you wrote like that, there was women poets, and then there were poets. And even in my house growing up, most of the writers in my house, and I think that was true for most people who are, you know, somewhere around my age, most of the writers in the house were men. Most of the books in the house were written by men. And so Dickinson was the first one that I ever read, who was a woman and a poet. And I was probably in middle school. But I kept on reading Dickinson's work because it was the only book in our house that was a woman and a poet. And I think that's been true for me over the course of my life. I've taught lots and lots of poems by all kinds of poets. And Elizabeth Bishop was a huge influence for me because she was a little like Dickinson in that she was breaking the rules of poetry in her time. And actually, I got interested in her work when I was studying for my comprehensive exams for my PhD and reading one of those great big tomes, you know, that's like the history of American poetry. Yeah, yeah. You know, like, oh, we're going to start with Ann Bradstreet and we're going to go right through. And they did. And then they had this one chapter at the end that was like Elizabeth Bishop, Theodore Redke, and somebody else. And it was like people we don't know what to do with. that was the chapter, right? And so then I got interested in why don't they know what to do with Bishop? And I think that one of the interesting things about Elizabeth Bishop as a poet was that she wouldn't fulfill anybody's expectation. She wasn't, you know, she wasn't going to be the gay poet or the woman poet and she actually wouldn't publish in anthologies that published only women because she wanted to be the poet. Mm-hmm. And I think that she and Dickinson, they have that kind of quiet voice, but quieter, quieter than say, somebody like Sharon Olds.
Right.
You know,
right. Who is not quiet.
Who is not quiet, no. But they're great ends of the spectrum in that way, yeah. You know, to give you who gives you courage and Jane Kenyon. It's really funny that you mentioned Jane mm-hmm. Kenyon because she's the one that I thought of. Elizabeth Bishop is somebody who has had a direct influence that I can look at and say, this is why she's influenced me. And I actually have poems where, like, she wrote in a waiting room, in the waiting room, and I wrote in another waiting room. So I went for it, like, to try to mess around with what she was doing.
You said earlier that you were going to read from Kenyon. Are you going to read from Bishop well for us?
You have a choice. So actually, Sue Ellen, if you don't mind my borrowing your book, at the very back of Sue Ellen's book is a poem called Let Evening Come, which is my favorite of all of Jane Kenyon's poems. And when I was reading around for this, I realized that I had picked up some of the anaphora, the repetition of it, in a poem of mine, and that I've been teaching this poem for years, and I didn't realize how much it influenced me. So it influenced me in a more subconscious way. But I could read the Bishop poem in the waiting room and then read in another waiting room. They're longer.
Well, you have us going now on Kenyon. You switched paths with us. So read the Jane Kenyon's poem, and then your own poem to indicate for us how.
That's a tough sell right there.
How it influenced
you. I think you should have like 3 hours before I read my poem. Between the Let Evening Come and my poem. But this is one of my favorite Kenyon poems. It's called Let Evening Come. Let the light of late afternoon shine through the chinks in the barn, moving up the bales as the sun moves down. Let the cricket take up chafing as a woman takes up her needles and her yarn. Let evening come. Let dew collect on the hoe abandoned in long grass. Let the stars appear and the moon disclose her silver horn. Let the fox go back to its sandy den. Let the wind die down. Let the shed go black inside. Let evening come. To the bottle in the ditch, to the scoop in the oats, to the air in the lung. Let evening come. Let it come, as it will, and don't be afraid. God does not leave us comfortless. So let evening come. And this is a poem. It's not about death, but it is about beginnings and endings. And I thought, it's a good poem for this time of year because everybody's graduating.
That's a little bit like new life.
It is a little bit also like death, because it's the end of a season.
It's the death of an old way of life.
Yeah, of an old way of life. And it's actually about my own college graduation. When I was about 24, I quit drinking. And that means that the only bottle of Dom Perignon that I will ever have
is in my past.
And was at my college graduation. A friend of mine who worked for a caterer gave me a gift of a bottle of Dom Perignon. And my friends and I pounded it in the parking lot out of the bottle. So this is a little bit about this moment, but I think the thing that that interested me about the connection with Jane Kenyon was how much I've started to rely on anaphora, on repetition.
Right. I was going to ask you to explain anaphora.
The way that she repeats, let evening come, let evening come. So there's this sense in this poem as I read it where I thought, oh, it's really relying on that, on what that repetition does to move you through time, but also to compare beginnings and endings. So this poem is called Commencement. We pass the Magnum hand to hand, six of us standing in a ring in the cinder parking lot behind the restaurant. Scott still wore the tuxedo he catered in the night before. Zip had long hair. No one had become an engineer or a mother. No one had died. Joni, Brown from her first week of lifeguarding sang off-key, "Bye, bye, Miss American Pie." The bottle came to me and I drank. Gold brocade, dense, alive, yellow rose that pricked inside. It was champagne. It was May. I held my cap and gown in my other hand, tipped the bottle back again. Dom Perignon, Moët and Chandon, the first of the days of long light. I was 23 years old. It was the beginning of the night. So, it's a little Jane Kenyon-y.
Well, let me ask you, Anne, the same question that that I asked Sue Ellen. How did your poetry change as a result of reading Bishop, and more particularly as a result of reading Kenyon?
I think that one of the things that Jane Kenyon taught me, she's very good at using poetic form, but not letting you see it. It's so that it's seamless, and I think that was important for me. But also, a little bit like Sue Ellen's, she gave me some courage because of the things that she talked about, and because of the quietness of her poems. And sometimes I think I need a poetic subject that has, you know, big drums behind it. But she writes about pretty simple things most of the time, and her metaphors are quiet and simple, and I think that has influenced me, that she shows me what it's possible to do with something like the scoop in the oats, you know. Mm-hmm. God, it's so simple and beautiful, but if you read her poetry often you see that she's able to bring something simple and beautiful because of the nature of the language that she uses. She brings those images to life. And I think it's amazing.
Adam.
Well, hello. How am I going to follow these two nice, brilliant poets? We're out of time. Thanks, Al. I'll see you next year.
I'm not worried about you, Adam. Your poetry is brilliant.
Good grief.
As I said, in preparation for our discussion, I went back and read some of your poems, and I found them.
Thank you.
And as well as you, Sue Ellen and Anne, I read some of your poetry again this morning, and I was really amazed at the quality of the work you produce, and even though, you know, you get kind of hard-shelled after a while, I was moved acquainting myself again. And they came as fresh. They came as new. And they brought something else to me this morning. So no worry, Adam. Yours as well. Who has influenced you, Adam?
Well, I've brought another rebel for you. You know, we've talked about Sharon Olds and Jane Kenyon and Elizabeth Bishop. Obviously, we didn't plan any of this in advance, but, you know, poets, we're all on the same wavelength.
We have not conspired.
Yeah, we have not conspired. There's no collusion here.
There's no collusion. We have not conspired over these poems. That's right.
But I've brought he is my favorite poet. Anybody talks to me for more than about 10 minutes about poetry knows that I have a deep affinity for a poet named Robinson Jeffers, who, much like Elizabeth Bishop, at least in her time, we've canonized her now, thank goodness, but he doesn't belong anywhere. He was a poet that sometimes gets thrown in with the modernists because he was quite prolific in the 20s and 30s and 40s before his reputation tumbled. But he was an odd duck, and so he didn't really fit. And the short version of him is he grows up a minister's son in Pittsburgh. And by the time he's a teenager, he's a language prodigy. He's studying in the best schools of Europe, and he's mastered Greek and Latin. But by the time he's in his early 20s, he's a bit of a rambler. He's on the West Coast. He's rejected his father's overbearing Presbyterian lifestyle and worldview. He's thinking about medical school and forestry, but ultimately realizes that he's a poet and that his love of Greek and Roman tragedy have taken him there, as he probably always knew somewhere deep down. And he really became one of the most iconic poets of the 30s, I think. He was on the cover of Time magazine in 36 or 37. You know, he was a perennial Pulitzer favorite. He turned down all kinds of distinguished awards and chancellorships because he didn't want them. He never taught. But he was a poet who I think we need desperately now, because if I had to summarize Jeffers briefly, I'd say he is a poet who is screaming at us to pay attention to our ecology. He is begging us to realize how deeply immoral we are, how toxic we have become towards each other. And he is someone who is always questioning those in power and authority. And I think that these are lessons for the early 21st century. He fell out of favor because during World War II, he opposed the U.S. entry into that war. And then some labeled him a Nazi sympathizer and a fascist. He was neither, and he was deeply, deeply wounded by those accusations. He was afraid that America was going to become an empire. And I often wonder if that prophecy hasn't in some ways come true in terms of our fetish of violence. But he is a poet who I think has a very unique outsider perspective on what it means to be part of a society or part of a species. And ultimately, he seems to be arguing in his poems that we bring most of our suffering upon ourselves and that we have the capacity to end that suffering, but we lack the will.
So, Adam, that's you're into a little bit about how he touched you.
Yes,
and
I could talk about Jeffers till next Tuesday.
I'm sure you could. Unfortunately, we've only got about 25 more minutes.
No, that's
so
fine. Yeah.
We'll
just throw something soft at my head. I'll stop.
No. Your comments are wonderful. Jeffers, how did he affect your poetry? How did he speak to your writing, your own writing?
So I've some pretty clear memories of being a college sophomore and junior. I was a history major. I was trying to finish in 3 years because of some financial hardships. I grew up in a blue collar family. My dad was a cop. My mother worked in a grocery store. The only books I remember are a partial Funk and Wagnalls encyclopedia that was missing a few volumes, and some romance novels. My mother had dreamed in her youth of being a journalist, but it wasn't meant to be. But I say that because as a history major in college, often late at night I'd stray from whatever paper or project I was working on and find myself in the poetry stacks, having fallen in love with poetry in high school and dabbled, but not fully understanding the psychic power or my own emotional draw to the art form. I don't think I could even articulate why in my teens, as so many of us do, are drawn to the arts, but don't really, maybe it's trying to figure out what we're going through at that age because we feel alone and mixed up. But I discovered Jeffers as a college student on my own, and maybe that's part of my love of him is that I've never really encountered him in a classroom. And so, you know, I found sort of a Jeffers community on my own, you know, sort of out there. But what draws me to him and what I keep drawing from his well, first, I think it's just a very capacious use of the English language. You know, he is a remarkable linguist. He has this just unending sense of the language and its etymology, and not just finding a good word, but the right word and the best word, a word with history. But I think he also gave a lot of my own private idiosyncrasies permission, right? I think that's one of the things that influence does, is it gives us permission to be ourselves. And so when I read Jeffers, I go, oh, I can write about history. Oh, I can write things that aren't necessarily nice about human beings. Oh, I can write about the destructive powers within us. I can write about hypocrisy. I can write about family. I can write about, you know, I can write in different voices. You know, Jeffers was also a dramatist, and so he's often experimenting with masks and the voices of characters and what we would call a persona poem or dramatic monologue. So he did all these things for me, and he continues to do them for me. And, you know, I think, too, when we think about influence, there is a kind of yearning to see some part of ourselves reflected in someone we know deep down is greater than us. And I think that, you know, in a selfish way is part of my relationship with Jeffers. I'm always talking to him on the page, partly because I want him to see a little bit of himself in me, too.
Well, read from Jeffers for us.
So this is probably my favorite poem of all time. So this is like bucket list stuff. I get to read my favorite poem on the radio, right?
This Absolutely.
This is a poem he wrote as a young man in his 30s when he was in England and Ireland looking at Anglo-Saxon graves. How chipper is that? But it was on a family trip, and I think in some ways some of his best poems came out of that trip.
Sue Ellen said once that if you don't understand a poem, all you need to know is that it's either about separation or death, and the poem will come alive for you. So I bow to your comment that you just made.
Yeah. So this is after writing all these poems while he was in the UK about seeing these graves and these sort of this past culture. This was one of the final poems he wrote on that trip, and it is both a celebration of and a turning away from death, which I think is what perhaps our best elegies do. It's called Inscription for a Gravestone. I am not dead. I have only become inhuman. That is to say, undressed myself of laughable prides and infirmities. But not as a man undresses to creep into bed, but like an athlete stripping for the race. The delicate ravel of nerves that made me a measurer of certain fictions called good and evil, that made me contract with pain and expand with pleasure, fussily adjusted like a little electroscope. That's gone, it is true. I never miss it. If the universe does, how easily replaced. But all the rest is heightened, widened, set free. I admired the beauty while I was human. Now I am part of the beauty. I wander in the air, being mostly gas and water, and flow in the ocean. Touch you and Asia at the same moment. Have a hand in the sunrises and the glow of this grass. I left the light precipitate of ashes to earth for a love token.
So Adam, turn to your poetry now and show us the relationship and what Jeffers has given you that shows up in your own work.
Well, I have a poem in my new book that's actually called The Light Precipitate of Ashes, but it's like 2 pages long and it's about ancient Egypt. So I didn't think it would be a good fit for our conversation. I'm going to read a fairly more recent poem, and it's a short poem. It's a sonnet. But I think the connection between the two has to do with recalibrating expectations. The Jeffers poem I just read is about rethinking our cultural paranoia about death. You know, I sometimes tell my students, we don't even like to say the verb to die. I love the euphemism pass away. When people die in my family, I cling to it. It's softer, it's majestic, but it is ultimately a euphemism. Things die. And the Jeffers poem says, do not be afraid. Instead of running from it, greet it there when it comes. And I think that's a theme that's sort of running through this entire conversation. Anyway, this is a poem that is thankfully not about death, but it's about the tenuous space that a poem creates. And it's a poem that I've been reading recently at National Poetry Month readings in April. I had a few readings I'm very grateful for. But it's a poem that I've opened with because it's about rethinking a space and the distance between expectation and reality, or expectation and possibility might be a better way thinking about it. And it's called Dear Reader. And so it's addressed to the reader I do not know. Dear Reader, for all I know, you hate the squeak of shoes across your kitchen tile, the nervous way I clear my throat when conversations turn to wine, or just the sight of ponytails on men whose temples gray. I have no clue what you can't forgive. Your window frames a different smidge of earth. Sometimes I yearn to sing the birthday song into a wail, but mime my tuneless lips instead. Silence makes a melody of awkward air that later blows the candles out. My gift is a small token wrapped hysterically with the obituary page. If you sift, you'll find the one who clutched at sirens.
It's beautiful.
Well, thank you.
So, Adam, how did your poetry change as a result of reading Jeffers, or has he always been a part of your work? You indicated that you found him very early on.
I think, to put it simply, what began in imitation probably has become osmosis. And what I mean by that is, you know, I found Jeffers in my early 20s, maybe late teens, really. And so, you know, you try and copy them the same way that, you know, right now somebody's in a bedroom trying to play a Jimi Hendrix riff. And, you know, so we imitate. But ultimately, one moves past that, realizing the frustration and futility of it, and one must find oneself. But I think when I look at my best poems, and I hope that the best poems I have are still ahead of me, but I see Jeffers' confrontation with history. I see Jeffers' ability to both examine self and nation in the same space and discuss them in the same space, to recognize that we cannot have serious conversations and keep them polite, that our serious conversations must ultimately be messy and invasive. And in the musical sweep of his line, you know, he begins as a metrical poet. He writes many free verse poems, but he ultimately sort of pioneers a very expansive kind of rolling stress. And so when I go to write my poems, I strive for that kind of bold music. And, you know, there's a kind of California coastline crashing in his language. And I'm not a California guy, but, you know, being here on the shore, trying to get something of the land, of the susurrus, of the cadence, of the, not just the local speech or the local color, but of the feel of the place. And I feel all those things bleeding into me, and I haven't quite honored them yet, but I'm getting there.
Let me ask a difficult question now. In our opening, I talked about Sir Isaac Newton and the letter he wrote to Robert Hooke, the natural philosopher. And he referenced his accomplishments, as I said, by saying, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants." You three have mentioned the three giants on whose shoulders you stand, and you've mentioned what their contribution to your writing has been. Let me ask you this, and Sue Ellen, let me begin with you. We've got a few minutes left. How have you seen further than Sharon Olds or Jane Kenyon? You have told us what they gave you. Mm-hmm. How have you seen beyond what they gave you? What have you? Anne and Adam can relax while you.
Thanks a lot.
While you think about this, I don't know that I have. What is different? You told us what you got from them. Uh-huh. Tell us now what is uniquely you that goes beyond what they gave you.
Well, I can only hope that it goes beyond. I guess the permission and the freedom from fear that the other two poets here, we've all talked about, I've continued to push in that direction. And I will say that perhaps I have dealt with even more difficult and emotional subject matter than either of those poets ever had to deal with.
We have read They, a magnificent book.
But if it hadn't been for them, I might not have ever taken those poems out of the bottom drawer. I tried not to for many, many years.
We would all be the less for it if you had not taken them out and published them. They are wonderful. And to our listeners, I highly recommend that they read that book. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. It's wonderful life experience, and it's a wonderful encouragement on how to live. Anne.
I guess I don't mean to be upsetting, but I don't love that metaphor. You know, that idea that writers are, I used to have a teacher who would come into the offices in graduate school, and he would say, go ahead, name the five top poets in English. And you had to, like, you know, rattle off what you who you thought were the five, and then he would critique what you said by who, like. So I'm not a fan of the let's have an art competition, or you know, like they got to here and now we get to there, and then the next generation gets to here. I don't think it works like that. I think it's much more of a conversation that we're having like we've all done here. Like we have a conversation, and then. But the cool thing about poetry is that I get to talk to people like Jane Kenyon, who I've never met, or like Elizabeth Bishop, who I never met, but also like T.S. Eliot. Right? And so we get to talk to each other in this way that's like no other way of talking. Valerie calls poetry a language within a language. And I think that's to me what we do. We talk to each other. We're not like standing on shoulders so somebody can stand on our shoulders so somebody else can reach a finish line.
You're questioning Sir Isaac.
Yes.
Let me rephrase the question.
Okay.
Let me rephrase the question then. I like Sir Isaac Newton's standing on the shoulders, but nonetheless.
But let me just say that, though. It does happen in science. In science, you have an experiment, and then the next experiment can go further. But it doesn't happen in art in that same way. Mm-hmm. It's not linear.
I agree. I agree. That's a very
Let me ask my question a little differently. You're having a conversation with Jane Kenyon.
Right.
Or Sharon Knowles. What do you bring to the conversation? What is it of you that you bring to that conversation? And I think that's getting more at what I'm asking here. You have a uniqueness, and you have learned from them, and they have influenced your work. So subject, style, metaphor,
yes.
You've grasped that. But nonetheless, there is something of you that you take all of that and bring to the conversation with her. What is that thing that you bring?
I guess that what to me was
a very personal question. I will admit.
I guess what I think each poet brings is specifically experience, voice, but also that if one poet has opened up new territory, then you get to go and live in some of their territory. And I think, and actually it's funny talking about Robinson Jeffers. I just taught Hurt Hawks, Hurt Hawk rather. And my students were so amazed, by the line. And I hope I don't misquote too much. I'd all things even, I'd rather kill a man than a hawk.
Yeah. That's the line.
Yeah. And we talked about it for, I think, a half an hour because he opened up that territory.
Yeah.
Where you could say, how are human beings not really as great as hawks, you know? Mm-hmm. And how is that? And I think that living in what we bring is if they can open up that territory, we can take it maybe just a little bit further so that other people can come in and have that conversation and live in the territory that we've opened up. And I hope that it's our experience, it's my experience, maybe some of my voice that opens up something that might connect with somebody else so they feel like they can speak.
Well, your poetry certainly connects. There's no question. There's no question about that. Adam?
Well, I think the only way I can answer, you know, there's two things that I find myself talking back to Jeffers or the idea of Jeffers. And one is, you know, this sense of, you know, isolation that a lot of times I want to embrace, a kind of retreat. But I think ultimately we can't criticize the world unless we're in the world. And so I get frustrated with Jeffers about that at times, because he removed himself and yet kind of pontificated a lot. And so, you know, in the kind of young rebel spirit that I sometimes feel with him, you know, when I make him into a kind of Freudian father figure in my head, I'm like, hey, buddy, you know, you didn't teach, you know, you didn't give readings, you know, you didn't go out there and deal with the rabble. You know, one of his sons did end up fighting rather valiantly in World War II. So he did know that sacrifice and that pain. But, you know, as somebody who, you know, teaches at a community college and every once in a while gets on a plane and has to go talk about poetry with strangers and all these other things, you know, we have to be in the world. And one can be angry at the world, and one can, as Jeffers put it, be angry at the sun, but you have to go out and look at the sun. You have to feel it on your skin. And the other thing about Jeffers is, while I love how prolific he was, I'm a bit of a prolific poet too. I write probably more than I should. But I think, you know, I wish he was more concise, and I wish he had a sense of revision that was a little bit more stringent. And at his best, he had a kind of rollicking unfurling. But, you know, some of his later work, I wish he was more self-critical, you know, and that before he put that book into the world, he was a little bit sharper with himself. I think he gave himself almost too much permission to be bitter at the end. And so that's a warning, right? It's a warning for all of us. When we have, if I may zoom out very quickly, when we think about the poets we love, the same way when we look at our parents or grandparents, people in our families, you know, there are all manner of lessons about how to age with grace. And you know, being mindful that people we love sometimes close or narrow, and that if poetry is speaking to us, we must always be opening. That's painful, but it's the great lesson it's giving us, so that we may be awake up until the last moment.
So, what you've indicated that you bring, that you have moved beyond Jeffers, is that you have taken.
Ooh, that's a scary phrase.
Yes, that is. I almost hesitate to use it.
His ghost is going to beat me up in the parking lot now.
No, because the point is here is that all three of you, you are unique. You are your own person. And even though the poets that you've mentioned have given you permission to be a woman poet, which I think is a profound comment, and given you courage to write about what's inside and what happens. And to you, Adam, moving beyond Jeffers into the world and taking what he gave you in terms of writing your poetry to engaging in the world. I mean, your poem Currency of Air, for instance, is engaging in the world in an incredible an incredible way. And I'm sorry for our listening audience to mention that without having time to read it, but
they can Google it. But, it'll be out there.
But read it. Plash and Levitation is the early book in which it's found in Adam's work. So read that and Catafalque and your middle book.
Oh, it's called The Fawn Abyss.
The Fawn Abyss. Read Adam, and to our audience again, read Ann Caldwell's Believing Their Shadows, and read about Mary telling her side of the story, which is, I find, just a fantastic poem, and her second book, Mother's Maiden Name, and of course, Sue Ellen, too many books to name your five, but the most recent one, your relationship with your daughter and your husband, and how that all works itself out is fantastic. And I suggest that that our listening audience read those works, plus Jeffers, I recommend to you, Kenyon, and Olds, and Bishop. I want to thank all three of you very, very much for being here today and for sharing your thoughts and your insights with us. And I want to thank all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.